This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. First up on today's show, we'll listen to a portion of my interview with writer, actress, and comedian Lily Tomlin conducted 15 years ago. A master or mistress of character-driven comedy, Tomlin's career spans 50 years from Laugh-In and the Merv Griffin Show to her new Netflix series, Grace and Frankie, co-starring Jane Fonda. When she joined me in 2000, she was touring the country with her Tony Award-winning one-woman show, A Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, co-written by her life partner, Jane Wagner. Let's take a listen. I read, and you never know when you get things off the internet if this is true or not true, something that you carry a notebook around wherever you go and write down things. And these were apparently some quotes from...
it's probably Jane's lines.
Or maybe Jane's lines.
I get credit for everything.
Here we go. If truth is beauty, how come no one has their hair done at the library?
Well, that may be mine. That sounds about like it.
I really like that one. I have to put my glasses
on.
Well,
okay.
Okay, if love is the answer, could you rephrase the question?
Yeah, I can't. I don't know. I don't want to saddle Jane with that one either.
This is also quite perceptive. If the nickname for Lawrence is Larry, why isn't the nickname for Florence Flarry?
Well,
it's good.
Yeah, well, we started that kind of stuff years ago, you know, because what would happen is because I did all these characters, and 30 years ago when I started out, people usually had one persona. And they would say to me, "Oh, people are going to get confused. They don't know who all they'll get. They don't know who you are." And I said, "And whenever I would try to invent a first person to do, it would turn into a character." And so I started doing these one line perceptions, sort of to be Lily, you know, because they'd say, "Well, you're so ordinary. You have such an ordinary voice and everything." Anyway,
one of the directors I was reading about talked about your style of acting as almost like possession. I mean, that it's acting, but it's you're like you're possessed by the characters.
Yeah, I know people make that to reference,
does that make sense?
I think any good actor, I think, wants to be possessed by their character. You know, I mean, that's what you sort of strive for, I guess.
Right. You mentioned your dad. You grew up in Detroit, right?
Yes, yes. My mother and dad both Southern. They're from Kentucky, but they'd gone to Detroit to work in the factories, you know.
So they were sort of they had grown up in Kentucky, and that sort of great migration north during the Depression.
Yeah,
I guess?
Probably shortly after, because right after the Depression, maybe, or 36 or something like that.
And your dad worked in a factory?
Factory. He was what's called a job setter, which is because he really wasn't educated. But he was intuitively gifted. If he had been educated, he would have been a tool maker, I suppose. But he could put a machine together to produce a part, you know, and that's called a job setter. And he was very proud. He would show me. He would show me. He would come home and show me, you know, different extrusions and threads and different shaped little brass parts and things that he would make the machine for. And I sensed the pride in that.
It was hard work, though, right?
Yes.
Physically.
Listen, I went to the factory with my dad. He worked there like 35 years. And I went down to the factory with him once. The noise is so profound. I thought, I couldn't believe my dad spent 35 years in that noise, you know, from morning till, you know, for a whole shift like that. So yeah, it's pretty daunting in some ways, and yet I've got pictures of my dad standing by the machinery, you know, and my dad was a kind of a street dude. He'd wear a white shirt and a hat and and he wouldn't wear a tie, but he'd always wear a white shirt and a suit jacket and Florsheim shoes to the factory, and then he'd change into his work clothes. And I always hung out at the bars and the bookie joints with him. You know, he was a gambler, and I went to the track with my dad and stuff like that.
And you were born Mary Jane.
Mary Jean. My mother's name is
Lily. Yeah.
So I took my mom's name. I always thought she had a great name. And I thought my dad's name was Guy. My dad's dead now. My mother's still living, and she's in very good health, and she's very funny.
I was wondering
adorable.
About that. Does she have your humor?
Do I have her humor? You better ask. My mother is truly witty. I'm kind of in earnest, you know. And I once, when I was about 20, I was recording my mother and a couple of my aunts, because I was really into my family and wanting to document everything. And when I listened to the tape back, I heard how witty my mother was, you know. And I had never appreciated the incredible quickness of her wit. And so my mother's very popular, and she people just enjoy her company. So the other day we'd gone to a family reunion with Jane's family, actually. And she, my mother and I were sitting in the hotel, and I said, "Mother, everybody just loves you. You're so adorable, and you have such a quick mind, and you always have something funny to say." And she looked at me, and she confided in me. She says, "You know, sometimes I think it up ahead of time."
Great.
So it was just so
great. That's great. But were you the sort of prototypically funny kid?
You know, I always put on shows and stuff, but I think I was more like, I think I was just sort of in love with my life in my neighborhood. I lived in an old apartment house, you know, filled with all kinds of people. And I was just fascinated with them. I just would go from apartment to apartment and immerse myself in their life and play the room. I would do whatever they were doing. I set myself in. I was just so that I could stick around, you know. And I mean, I'd go to one apartment and be propagandized with communist literature, and I'd go to another one and I'd be propagandized with very reactionary politics, and I'd go to another one where people have no politics whatsoever, and you know, I'm very educated, uneducated, and I circulated in the building. I was very socially mobile.
Watching.
Yeah, hanging out.
Hanging out. It's great. I'm just wondering how, because we know from Martin Rowan Laffin, I mean, that's sort of where the country sort of first discovered you. But was it a difficult transition from television to movies for you?
Well, you know, I never thought of that. I didn't know how hard it was. I didn't know that people didn't want you to be in the, you know, that you couldn't cross over, especially if you were like Ernestine, the telephone operator. Well, I resent that. So I had optioned a book for myself, actually, called Maiden, which was written by a woman named Cynthia Buchanan at the time. This was 1971.
Whoa.
And I just assumed that I would get it done and I would produce it. And it was a great, great comic role, comic tragic role. And Cynthia's still a friend of mine and Jane's. And Jane Wagner, the author of The Search.
Right.
But what happened is I did buy that. I did option that book and I did develop a screenplay. And then what happened is I got the part in Nashville because Altman and I had the same agent. And Altman probably never saw Laugh-In. So he didn't, you know, and Altman is just he's a very expansive, free-flowing guy. And, you know, I get presented to him and he says, "Yeah, okay." He's just
that
like
was
that.
It.
He's serendipitous.
Well,
he just takes what comes to him. And so I got that part. And then he, in the meantime, he read the screenplay and he was going to produce Maiden and Joan Tewksbury was going to direct it. And then California Split was just being released and they came down from Columbia, who had optioned Maiden. I bought Maiden for the project, and they wanted him to cut something 6 minutes out of California Split, and he punched somebody in the nose.
Oh.
They fell in the pool, and so Maiden never got done.
But Nashville did, and you give such a touching performance in this, and very different from the kind of character that we would have seen on Laugh-In. In fact, got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, I did.
A woman in a unhappy marriage with two deaf children, and there's one scene we can't really play it. Again, it's your eyes. You're in a bar and you're seeing the Carradine character, who's this rock and roll star, and the scene just is of you watching him. And the sort of loneliness, the anticipation, all that is contained in that scene. It was extraordinary when I first saw it. I mean, I remember it to this day.
Yeah, I know. I got that was important in my career at that time.
To be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, to have that opportunity.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
And coming off of a show like Laugh-In.
Sure. So you have fond memories of working with Robert Altman?
Oh, yes. God, yes. Of course. You know, I've had some of my very best movie, experiences with him. Shortcuts.
Right.
I love Shortcuts.
Right.
And Bob's, he's just a fascinating person to be with and work with and everything. And one of my favorite things he ever said to me, I was complaining to him about a project I was doing and I didn't know. And I said, "What should I do, Bob?" And he said, "Giggle and give in."
That's good advice, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's so interesting to watch you and Steve Martin together.
Okay.
In All of Me, the two of you obviously in tandem. And again, what was it like to work with him?
Well, that's one of my favorite movies, you know, and I've always been really fond of Steve. And Steve has there's a kind of deep core of kind of loneliness in him that I really respond to, you know, and as funny and zany as he is, and he's very, very brilliant, too. But yes, I just related well to him.
And your comedy kind of meshes. I mean, not all comedy.
That's what everybody
really
says. I know. I always wanted to do another movie with him, but it never came up.
That was my 2000 interview with actress, writer, and comedian Lily Tomlin, currently starring in the Netflix series Grace and Frankie. We end this segment on a sad note. Anthony Reilly, the noted Philadelphia street performer and former contestant on NBC's The Voice, took his life over the weekend. He had joined us on Radio Times in 2007 to discuss the changing street performing laws and to sing us this song, "Change Gonna Come," by Sam Cooke.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like a river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know, oh, I know that a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it is. It's been too hard to live in, and I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the skies. It's been a long time coming, but I know, oh, I know that a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it is. See, I go to the movies, then I go downtown. But somebody keeps on telling me, son, turn around. It's been a long time coming, but I know, oh, I know that a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, it is. See, I go to my brother, and I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me, knocks me back on my knees. And oh, I know there's been times when I thought I could last for long. But now I think that I can carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know, oh, I know that a change gonna come. Oh, yes it is. It's been a long time coming, but I know, oh, I know that a change is gonna come. Whoa, whoa, yes it is.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Edgar Carret, the outspoken author of surreal short fiction, is releasing his most personal body of work next week. The Seven Good Years, a memoir, doesn't abandon his short story style, but is more focused on his personal experiences as an Israeli, as a writer, and as a man. He joined me last year when he was in town for the Jewish Film Festival, which screened a short documentary about him called What Animal Are You? We discuss his life, Israel, and his distinct writing style, which prompted Salman Rushdie to call him the voice of the next generation. Let's take a listen. Do you get your humor from your father?
It's funny because I think that every member of my family is funny, but each of them is funny in a different way. And I don't think I'm funny like any of them. If anything, I'm closest to my mother because my father had a kind of a more compassionate kind of humor, and my mother had kind of a darker kind of humor.
Well, you tell this story about both of your parents made it through the Holocaust, but nonetheless had to live under the horrors of the Holocaust. And your father, I guess with his family, hiding in a hole in the ground in what was then Poland.
Yes, they hid in a hole in the ground which they dug in a farm of a Polish farmer who agreed, you know, to hide Jews. And the plan was to stay there one night while the Germans would search the farm. But unluckily for them, the Germans had built their headquarters in that farm. And they had to stay there for more than 600 days. And it was a very, very small hole. They couldn't stand straight in it, or they couldn't lie in it. They had to sit down for 600 days. And when the Russians had liberated this area, you know, they were unable to move their muscles. The muscles
were sort of stuck in this crouching, I guess, or sitting position.
Yeah.
But as you tell it, I mean, I guess perhaps it tells your father's perhaps optimistic humor, which is, you know, there's one thing, if you could be a champion, why not learn to do it? And he learned to be an excellent sleeper.
Yeah, he said that he was the world champion sleeping, and that basically he would wake up and ask his father if the war is over, and when the father said no, it's still on, so we would go and sleep again.
And interesting that he would nap in the afternoon as well.
Yeah, my father loved to sleep. Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that was a way of escaping?
It was escaping, but it was also kind of a, for him, it was a place to be creative, because he would dream a lot and he would remember his dreams. And it would seem that in his dreams, he was not confined to all those things that had confined him in life, you know, the lack of formal education, the fact that he had to work hard all his life. So when he would dream, his dreams would be crazy, you know, and he could go and do all those kind of things that he was unable to do in real life.
Kind of like your stories, or some of your stories, do you think?
Very much like my stories. Actually, I have one story that it's based on a story that he told me.
Uh-huh. And did your mother tell stories as well?
Yes. Actually, my mother is more of the writer in our family. She never published anything, but she would write stories. Uh-huh. And she was like in a creative writing class for elderly people.
Uh-huh. And where was she during the war, during the Holocaust?
She was in the Warsaw Ghetto, and she... both her mother and her kid brother were murdered in front of her eyes, and she also lost her father. So she basically survived on her own.
And just to her own, perhaps, luck and determination?
Well, she said that there were a few things that helped her. One of them is that she has a pale skin and she doesn't look Jewish at all. And the other is that she was very, very good with languages. She can speak languages with no accent at all, so she could actually speak German and some Russian and English, French. Yeah, so she could always communicate. She said that it was very helpful because it was more difficult to dehumanize somebody who could speak to you, you know, so.
Did they talk a lot about that, about the war when you were a kid growing up?
No, most of the time they didn't speak about it. It actually, strangely enough, you know, my wife knows more about what my parents had been through in the war than I do, because I think we had this kind of almost a silent agreement that they don't talk about it a lot, and it's for our own good, you know. It's better for me and better for them not to speak about it a lot.
Do you think that's true?
It worked, you know, it worked. So I don't think I can protect it ideologically, but I've never kind of challenged it, you know. Even until this day, I don't sit with my mother and say to her, tell me stories about things that happened to you in the war. When she wants to, she can mention something.
When did you start writing stories? Were you a kid that wrote stories in school, for instance?
No. Actually, I've majored in math and physics, and I was supposed to go to this kind of technological institute, But in Israel, when you were 18, you go for 3 years for compulsory army service. And during that service, I served with my best friend who had shot himself.
He killed himself?
Yeah, and I was with him when he did that. And basically, right after his funeral, I was sent to have a 48-hour shift in the room in which I found him dying. And it was a very, very difficult experience. You know, I was 19 at the time, and I felt that I had to do something to survive it, because for 48 hours you're in a room without windows, totally closed, you know, with the bullets that went through his temple still stuck in the wooden
wall,
yeah. And I wanted to do something, and I just sat down and I wrote my first story, which is called Pipes, you know.
Who did you show it to?
I showed it to my older brother. He's like, for me, he was always my Yoda, you know. He was my mentor. And the first thing I did after I finished my shift was to take a bus to his place and to wake him up and show him the story.
So it was your friend's suicide that, in a sense, made you a writer?
Yeah, for sure. for sure. I never had any aspiration. And, you know, and even now in the family, I'm not considered somebody who knows how to write nice. You know, if you have to write a birthday cards or to write a note to the neighbor that he should move his car because he's blocking, you know, a driveway, then my wife does that because everybody says that, you know, when I write stuff, nobody understands what I want, you know. But for me, it's like writing is something that I save it only for stories. And lately, I've also kind of started writing opinion pieces. But for me, writing is for stories and screenplays.
When you write a story, is it an image? Is there a sort of a phrase that you hear or something that gets you kind of thinking this or working on what ends up being a short story?
Yeah, it could be the image. It could be a phrase. It could be even like, you know, like one of the latest stories I've written, I found myself reading a piece by somebody I knew. And I had those kind of vain and arrogant feelings saying, oh, you know, who does she think she is? It's so stupid. It's so dumb. And one way for me to fight alienation is at the moment when I see somebody that I kind of look down on, I sit down and write a story. And in this story, this person is the protagonist. And then I'm him. And then when I'm him, I have to empathize with the situation. I have to understand it. I cannot alienate myself from it. So I sat down and I just wrote myself as this person that I was patronizing a moment ago. And in the end, I found how much I identify with that person.
And did you go through a period of not being either able to write or be able to complete things that you had written?
Yes. With me, I really don't have any writing discipline. It's not that I sit down by the computer and say I have to write something. I usually write only when I have a story to write. And there are periods in my life in which no story presents itself. So I keep myself busy. There are a lot of other things that I do. But there are times in which I don't write. And when I don't write for a long time, I start missing it. You know, it's really, it's less kind of like a junkie missing a hit, but it's more like missing a family relative that you haven't seen in a very long time.
You write in Hebrew, do you not?
Yes.
And then your works are all translated?
Yeah, to English or to other languages. And my books came out in 35 languages.
In 35 languages. So we're having this conversation in English. I'm trying to figure out how, are you translating what I'm saying and then putting it into Hebrew and then back into English as we're talking? How does that work for you?
That's what I'm doing, but I'm doing it so quickly that even I can't notice it.
You know? Really?
But I feel many times that I say a sentence, and when I get to the third word, I realize that I don't know how to say the fifth one. So I have to take kind of a detour, you know, and say something else instead. It still happens to me that.
And when someone is translating your work, who obviously have a greater command of the English or American language, how do you know they're getting it right?
Well, it's funny because I have a very close relationship with my translators, and we always talk a lot, and many times I say to them that I'm not sure enough of my English, but I'm sure enough of the story. So I explain to them something in this paragraph or in this sentence, and then they tell me if it's right or not. And it's funny. But the funniest story about my translators is that one of my translators is Nathan Englander.
Oh, sure.
And with Nathan, when you check his translation, you have to make sure that he didn't add a character. Because he has this kind of thing that because he's not used to translating and he's used to being a writer, so he translates the story, but sometimes he can add a little action or a chair or a description. And, you know, and a couple of times I've kept them, you know, because they were so good.
Yeah.
But I have to say to him, hey, Nathan, you know, this guy doesn't exist in this story. You just brought a friend. It's not allowed.
What were some of the early stories that had an influence on you or that maybe even some of the first stories you heard as a kid?
Well, I think that the thing that had influenced me a lot as a child was the bedtime stories that my parents would tell me because my parents insisted on making up the bedtime stories I've heard. My mother's one of her maybe only strong memories of her parents were the bedtime stories that they would tell her. And since it was in the ghetto, they had to make up the stories themselves. So both my mother and my father would make up stories, and those stories it stayed with me.
And do you think short stories are sort of, you know, within the hierarchy of writing, a more sort of maligned form?
Wow, I don't even know what maligned
means. Oh, that's sort of like if you're a really serious writer, you're going to write a novel. It's 200 pages long or more.
I can tell you that not only in the U.S., but in many countries, people said to me, how about we offer you like a 2 books deal and you will publish this collection of short stories and give you a lot of money, but you have to promise that the next book will be a novel. And I've kind of walked away because I both didn't feel like doing it and I wasn't even sure that I can. But nowadays, I'm pretty sure I can write a novel. But but there is something about the intensity of short stories, about the fact that I don't know what I'm writing while I'm writing, about the process itself, that it's something that is difficult for me to walk away from.
I was reading an interview with you and something that you said about the writers that you like, Gogol, Nabokov. You said, I also really like young Jewish American writers like Jonathan Safran Foer, Gary Steingart, Michael Chabon. There's something in the Jewish American identity that is actually closer to me than the Israeli identity, because over there, people are trying to fight or hide their Jewish roots. They have almost something that's anti-Jewish.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make much sense as a quote, but maybe I can try and explain it. What I think is that, you know, that the Israeli tradition in many ways try to be an anti-Jewish tradition in that sense that Jews in the diaspora were cosmopolitan, were not nationalistic, didn't work the land, you know, didn't have any agriculture, didn't have their own army, then Israel was supposed to fix all those things that Jews didn't have. So suddenly, we're not that much people of the book, but we have the best high-tech companies in the world, you know, and all our leaders are not spiritual leaders like they used to be in the diaspora, but they are army generals. So I think that in the Israeli narrative, the diaspora Jews were victims. They did something wrong. So they got themselves in pogroms, in the Holocaust. And the idea was to build a new entity that will not have those Jewish faults. So this is what I mean, that you know, that the Israeli identity is in a way anti-Jewish. And what I think is that Israeli literature always talks, or many times talks about the country, and it talks less about this kind of question of identity, asking yourself, what does it mean to be Israeli? Because the Israeli nationality is not like any other nationality. Israel is a crazy place. You know, it's the only country that is based on a book. You know, here in the States, you make films out of books. But in Israel, what happened was that Herzl's book, Altnoy Land, which kind of had this fantastic idea of a Jewish state, became real. So, but even though it's so strange, and even though there are so many tensions and so many obscure terms like Zionism, many people can argue what Zionism means, then in the bottom line, people don't ask themselves a lot of questions about personal identity. Huh. What I think that many Jewish Americans do.
And I know that Kafka has been a big influence on you. Let me ask you, first of all, why that is.
Well, I was introduced to Kafka during my compulsory army service. During basic training, I would get into a lot of trouble with my commanders, and I wouldn't get weekend leaves. You know, they would punish me, and I would stay. How do you say? They grounded me.
Yeah, they would ground you. Is that because you were sort of challenging their orders or questioning their authority?
Not on purpose. Like, I was asking all kind of questions that were genuinely innocent, but were enough to get them angry. And in one of those weekends, I found the book Metamorphosis and Other Stories.
Metamorphosis, yeah.
And when I read Kafka, the first feeling I felt was this great comfort that there was one guy in this world that was even more stressed and less competent than I was, you know. And my second thought after that was, wow, maybe I can write too. And it took me a year before I began writing, but I think there was something in Kafka that I realized that unlike the Israeli tradition of writing, in which the writers are very much like kind of secular prophets, are people with the answers, then with Kafka, he didn't seem to have an answer to anything, just a lot of questions. And there was something very inspiring about that.
You've also been making films. And in your own mind, do you see a connection between short stories and films? Or does that allow you to, in a sense, express another part of yourself?
Well, for sure, it's another part of myself. And I must say that the things that had driven me to films, except for the fact that I always loved films, was the fact that it was a collaborative act. And when I started writing fiction, I had no problem because nobody wanted to read it. So I kept my day job. But the moment that I became successful enough to give up my day job, then it became very lonely. You know, you would write stories all day, but you wouldn't interact with a lot of people. And the idea that when you make a film, that not only you interact, but you interact in such a way that in the end there is a film on the screen that both you, the cinematographer, the actors, all of the people who are involved in it, see something from them on the screen. They say, this is me. I made this film. This is what I felt, you know. And it, there is something very, very intimate in this process when you work with people on the film. You know, my wife said to me when we worked on the film, she said, I'm jealous of you and the cinematographer who was a guy. Because she said, I feel that sometimes you tell him things that you never told me.
Interesting. And with films, you get to watch people watch your work, right? You don't get to watch people read necessarily. Right?
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. Because the truth is that the reason that I like so much public readings is that it gives you a chance to see how an audience reacts to your stories. And with film, it's easy. You know, you just enter a screening and you see when they laugh and when they cry and when they get bored and check for messages on the iPhone.
And that was my interview with Israeli short story author Edgar Keret, conducted last year. His new collection, The Seven Good Years, a memoir, is set to be released next week by Riverhead Books. Coming up after the break, we'll hear a portion of my interview with Sir Ian McKellen. He stars as the titular character in the upcoming film, Mr. Holmes. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Many have portrayed Sherlock Holmes on the small and big screen. George C. Scott, Roger Moore, Leonard Nimoy, Peter O'Toole, Michael Caine, Charlton Heston, Robert Downey Jr., and Benedict Cumberbatch have all portrayed literature's most famous sleuth. Now add to that list Sir Ian McKellen, who's taking his turn this summer in the film Mr. Holmes. It tackles the final days of Holmes' life as he struggles with losing his once sharp mind. Ian McKellen joined me back in 2000 on the heels of his appearance in the first X-Men movie. Let's take a listen. Well, let me go back to 1988. You were, I guess, on a BBC debate or discussion show when you came out publicly. Did you plan this? Was it spontaneous? Did you think about it before it happened?
Well, coming out is a journey that gay people take. If they're lucky, it's a short journey. And you make it in the company of your family and your friends who help you and support you. And then the journey's over and the sun shines, as it were. If you're my generation, brought up at a time when to be gay and to make love to another man was illegal, you're put in prison, then that tends to do something to your perception of what the world is and what your place in it is. Even if you're having a successful career, in my case as an actor, you feel your gayness, your sexuality is something that you're going to keep very private. And I did. I didn't tell my parents, and I hadn't spoken to the media about it, but my colleagues all knew, and all my friends. I lived openly with my boyfriend, and we went out in public and so on. But the point came when I thought I'd had enough of this, and that perhaps I was a little less obsessed with being an actor than I was with being a human being. And I was greatly helped by Armistead Maupin and his lover at the time, Terry, the author of Tales of the City, which I see the third part is coming
on Showtime.
On Showtime.
Coming up.
Is it next week, I think? And I'd casually said to Armistead, a new friend, do you think I should come out? And as he seems to devote a lot of his life in encouraging people to do just that, because he knows, A, the world would be a better place if we were all out, but B, he knew that I would be happier as a person, and that's...
And that's true.
Proved. Oh, immeasurably. Having come back from those conversations in San Francisco, I found Mrs. Thatcher introducing this very nasty little law, which is still on the statute books, which inhibits teachers from speaking positively about homosexuality in schools. But that's the issue on which I came out and said, look, I'm talking about this personally because it affects my life and affects society's attitude to people like me. And having done that, I wondered why I hadn't done it years before, because this millstone that had been sitting on my neck and I hadn't known about was lifted.
And the reaction of your family, the public, did the world come to an end?
My 84-year-old stepmother at that time, who I was very nervous about telling, I didn't know what she would think. Although I shouldn't have worried, because she's a Quaker, and Quaker of all groups, particularly religious groups, have been models of understanding about sexuality, and homosexuality in particular. So I told her, and she said, oh, Ian, I'm so relieved. I thought you were going to tell me something really dreadful. and it was the same with everybody. Although it was interesting, she said, are you going to tell your sister? I said, well, of course I've got to tell Jean. She said, well, do be careful. I hope it's all right with Jean. Well, when I told Jean, she said, are you going to tell your aunt? I hope it'll be all right with your aunt. And I told my aunt, and she said, are you going to tell your nephew? Everyone was worried about somebody else. It's very interesting. And, of course, if you're gay yourself, you're worried about everybody else. What will their reaction be? Will they stop having me as a friend? Will they stop taking me seriously? Will they stop obeying my orders if you're an employer? will they stop employing me? Usually that's the problem. Actors feel that. You know, Hollywood stars feel they're going to lose their careers if they come out. Head teachers feel the same about their jobs and so on.
Well, did anything change in your career? Were you offered more gay roles? Were you not offered roles because you were clearly gay?
My film career took off immediately. I deliberately chose as my first job having come out to play John Profumo, the English politician about whom little is remembered except that he was a raging heterosexual. And having played
that... A very randy one, wasn't he?
Yes, and having played that apparently with some conviction. And after all, I've been playing straight parts all my life. And I've played straight rapists, happily married straight people, unhappily married straight people. You know, the full gamut of interesting characters. And that's the end of it, as far as I'm concerned. Or rather, the beginning of my film career, and people don't seem to mind. Perhaps people of my age are acceptable as being gay. It's the youngsters who are told, hide it, lie about it, you won't have a career without it. And my answer to those people is, are you sure you want a career which demands that you lie, demands that you hide and are dishonest? Because that's not good for your soul, and it won't be good for your acting in the end.
Have you found, though, that since being knighted, and you are Sir Ian McKellen, certainly in England, that has given you kind of entree, cachet, to be able to speak directly to perhaps members of Congress about these issues?
Indeed, and one of the first things I did, having come out, was to talk to the Prime Minister, John Major, on gay issues in Downing Street, and through Stonewall, which was the first professional lobby on behalf of gay people in the UK. We speak regularly to the government and have become now indispensable in the process of removing, lopping off the rotten limbs of the body politic, which have for far too long discriminated against this minority of which I happen to be a member. Yes, that was my main motive for taking a knighthood. I was out. I was already out. I wasn't one of those people who became a knight because they'd hidden the fact that they were gay, like, I'm afraid, Noel Coward and Alec Guinness, and as we now learn, and others. But yes, it is in a class-ridden society like the United Kingdom, it is very useful to have a handle to your name, and doors tend to open when you knock on them.
Was it, though, controversial when you were knighted? You were out, you were criticizing the government. They had these laws that did discriminate against gays and lesbians, and here they were knighting you. Was that a conflict for you?
I wonder if Mrs. Thatcher knew what she was doing.
Really? But she's a pretty savvy politician.
Yeah, but in fact, the day that they telephoned me to say, ask me would I accept a knighthood, she was actually being removed from office. And I was watching on television in Paris, where I was on tour, her about to come out of Downing Street for the last time. And yet there was somebody on the phone from inside Downing Street calling me saying, Mrs. Thatcher wants you to become a knight. I said, well, if it gets her out of office any quicker, yes, I'll accept it.
So you're willing to sacrifice yourself for the cause. But some people did criticize you.
Yeah, fair enough. People like Derek Jarman, the outstanding filmmaker and visionary, really, and openly gay man throughout his career, I think, was a little bit nervous that somebody like me, new to the game of being a public gay man, mightn't fully represent the large constituency of gay people who's who don't have a voice. But although in public he was chastising me for accepting an award from a homophobic government like Mrs. Thatcher, in private he was calling me up and saying, isn't it fun we're getting all this coverage in the papers? And that was very much his line. He thought you should stir up discussion, and I rather agreed with him. But in public, it's rather depressing that still his writings are coming out and he's saying, I hate Ian McKellen. Mm.
To this day?
Well, his posthumous works and diaries are still coming out. But I know that 2 weeks before he died, he sent me a message saying he thought the work I was doing was wonderful and that Stonewall, which he'd initially objected to as being too tied, too close to government for its own good, making the case in private rather than the streets in public, which was his line, he relented because he could see that actually we were making the world a better place. And so the world is inching there. We're getting a little bit better. And that's happened, I think, because there's been steady lobbying and public discussion. And, things are improving.
I read somewhere that Macbeth was your favorite of Shakespeare's characters. Is that true? Can you say that without, upsetting the other characters?
Well, it's usually the part that you're currently playing that is your favourite because it's the one you're most obsessed with. And as I'm out of work at the moment, I suppose I'm allowed to say I don't have a favourite at all. But Macbeth was a particularly happy production of a play which, is thought to bring bad luck to people who are in it.
Oh, is that right?
Well, they're thought to be accidents that happen that wouldn't happen in other plays. But Lady Macbeth was Judi Dench. The director was Trevor Nunn, who's the current director of the National Theatre. The cast of 12 was absolutely remarkable and of the highest standard. We did it in a tiny theatre in Stratford, 100 people, who were locked into the theatre just for the 2 hours in which we played it, no interval. And I know that it became the most wonderful thriller that there's ever been. And my sister, who's a teacher, uses the video version to teach. And time and again, she's showing it to her kids who say after an hour, oh, please, can we stay on after school because we want to find out what happens at the end of it. Well, if you can get that in Shakespeare, you're onto something. And I think it was the total success of that particular interpretation. No scenery. Audience very close to the actors, which began to change my attitude to acting. Up to that point, I think I'd been rather proud of my ability to shout loudly in a large theatre. But since then, I've been increasingly interested in a more minimalist approach, which has ended up with me doing a lot of movies of late. And I think that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't had that experience of doing Macbeth
theatre. You're talking about then the intimacy with an audience. And I guess, I mean, certainly movies, I've heard actors say from the stage, which are the grand gestures and the loud voice, it does become more minimal. That it's the subtleties of acting that really seem to matter.
Yes. Of course, when you're rehearsing a play, there's all sorts of subtlety going on as you're trying to discover what the character and his relationships with other characters is. But when you come into a large theatre, if you're mindful of the people, as I always am, in the cheap seats right up at the backs where I used to sit, they've got to get the show. They've got to get the message. But it does become a bit of a message. You do start semaphoring. Hey, listen to this. This is important. Hey, look at me now. So I'll give you a gesture and wave a white hanky, as it were. And that means that the actor is in danger of coming between the character and the audience and presenting the character on a plate, as it were. Now, when you're in front of a camera that's as close as we are across this table, then there's no need for artifice. I can just be. I don't have to select. You, the audience, do the selecting. You observe. And it isn't me observing the character and then sending the message to you. That's one disadvantage of working in a large theatre. Yeah. And that's why, on the whole, I don't like to work in them.
But does that mean you're more comfortable with yourself as an actor? Or you just have come to learn about what you can do in front of a camera?
I I think it's, yes, just a matter of a little bit more self-confidence, perhaps, which is related to being out as a gay person. You know, a lot of actors are gay, and I think it's because they spend, if they're in my generation, they've had to spend an awful lot of time hiding from society, and so we go into a job which requires us to hide. Although, of course, the minute an actor starts acting and opens his mouth, you can perceive things about him that he doesn't know he's revealing.
Right. It's like hiding in plain sight, yes?
Yes, exactly.
For all of us to see. I read that your parents used to take you to plays as a little boy,
yeah,
and really introduce you to the theater, but that you were a shy child and that acting gave you the courage, I guess, to not be shy or to somehow get out of yourself. And I know that's common with actors.
Mm. And I think, sorry to keep coming back to it, but it is sort of central to my life. One of the reasons I was shy or unconfident in public at parties, meeting people for the first time, was that I had this secret that I didn't feel I could, they didn't want me to share with them, which was that I was gay.
Did you know as a little
so
boy?
I think. You know, when I became sexually aware, the people I was attracted to were men. It didn't seem to me anything I could do about it or wanted to do about it, actually. But acting became... I'm rather repeating myself here, aren't I? But acting what became an escape from this shyness. And but I think I only finally got rid of shyness. No, I still feel it. Don't we all feel shy?
Oh, sure.
You know, we all feel uncomfortable in certain situations. And I suppose I still do, but less and less as I feel that I am my own person. But you can't feel your own person unless you're honest.
Let me just read one little thing that you were quoted, actually. I guess it was Entertainment Weekly interviewing you about your Oscar nomination. And this is about creating a character. You say, there comes a moment, usually in rehearsal or maybe very early on when we're shooting, when it all comes together and just for 2 or 3 seconds, everyone is agreed, including me, that it wasn't me anymore. It was the character. And then you go on to say, it will depend very heavily on the way I look. It will also depend on me having thought about the character and talked about it a lot. Once that moment has happened, then I can relax and apply my memory of what it was like during those few seconds to the rest of the part. And what a magic moment that must be.
It is, and it needn't actually happen whilst you're playing the part. It can happen if you're looking in the mirror. I think it's a hint that Stanislavski gives in one of his writings. Improbably, you'd think he would it would depend much more on hard work, but he says, sit in front of the mirror, paint your face, make yourself look like the character, and having looking like the character and looking at yourself, you might then feel like the character. And so it can happen in that way as well. But it's just that reassurance, that's what it feels like. Oh, that's how he walks. Oh, that's why the voice comes out like that. Oh, that's why he's the man he is. Then you can begin to spread that out over the rest of the part, not too thinly. I do seem to play a lot of villains.
Yes,
but
you do.
I think that's not because I'm gay, but because I'm British.
Again, that was my interview with Sir Ian McKellen, conducted 15 years ago. He's starring in the upcoming film Mr. Holmes, which finds an aging Sherlock struggling with his deteriorating mind. And that wraps it up for this edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.